Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. We spend a lot of time talking about how important it is to take care of your mental health. Therapy is an excellent way to do that. BetterHelp is an affordable mental health care option that fits right into your busy schedule. Just answer a few quick questions about your needs and preferences, and BetterHelp will match you with one of the thousands of experienced mental health professionals in their network. You can talk to your therapist over text, chat, phone, or video. You get to pick what works best for you, your comfort, and your schedule. If you feel like your therapist isn't the right fit, BetterHelp makes it easy to switch to someone new at no additional cost. So give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. BetterHelp is offering our listeners 10% off their first month of therapy. Just go to betterhelp.com/musicspeaks to get started. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/musicspeaks to get 10% off your first month of therapy.
Hey guys, we wanted to take a quick minute to tell you about our recent partnership with the Amazing Bones Coffee Company.
Let's face it, you're probably sick and tired of drinking that old plain Jane coffee brand every morning. Well, fret not, dear listener. Bones Coffee is here to kick your taste buds into high gear.
Bones Coffee has a wide variety of flavors to choose from, including maple bacon, peaches and spring, island grog, and my personal favorite, chocolate raspberry.
Once you become hooked on the coffee, you'll be excited to learn that they have plenty of merch options to choose from as well. T-shirts, mugs, tote bags, the list goes on.
You can buy their coffee in whole bean, ground, and even evil single serve options.
Guys, we wouldn't lie to you. This coffee is great, and we know that you're going to love it too, which is why we have partnered up with Bones Coffee, and now our listeners have an exclusive discount code.
Make sure to use the code MUSICSPEAKS at checkout for 10% off your order.
That's right, James. Go to bonescoffee.com to kickstart your new coffee addiction and use the code MUSICSPEAKS for 10% off today. If you're anything like me, free time is limited. So things like yard work are just not doable. And if you're also like me, you don't even own a lawnmower. That is why All Above Landscaping is the right choice. All Above includes a variety of options when it comes to your landscaping needs, including lawn installation, design, irrigation, debris removal, maintenance, and much more. If you're in the city of Sumter and you're looking for reliable service at a friendly price, give All Above Landscaping a call today. It's 803-464-7414. Mention that you heard this ad on this podcast and you'll get a special discount on your first service. Again, that's 803-464-7414. Call All Above Landscaping today. Like so many of you, we battle depression through life's ups and downs.
Music has always been the one thing we could rely on to get us through the tough times we all face.
Follow us on our journey as we discuss the healing power of music, share our stories through songs and lyrics,
interview musicians and other artists,
break down genres,
deep dive into band biographies,
and much, much more.
This is the Woodward Fail
Music Speaks Podcast
with Blake Mosley,
James Todd,
and Amanda Dolan.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Woodward Fail Music Speaks Podcast, where we fight depression with the power of music. I'm your hands that host, James Cox. I have another great interview today. He is Benny from Muted Circus. But let me tell you about it first before we have him on. Muted Circus is a pop singer-songwriter. Yeah. With 5 EPs already available on Spotify, Apple Music, and so much more. You can get it anywhere you listen to your favorite tunes. With his latest release, Hear My Rattle, which came out November 15th, 2024. Benny, what's up, man?
Hey.
How you doing?
How you doing?
Good. Great, good. I hope that was okay. That was very short, but I figured, you know, we can talk about
you know, if you spoil all the info in the intro.
What good is it, right? Yeah.
That's right. It's always funny if people are too nice in the intro, then you feel like, oh, I'm not going to live up to the introduction. Right, but if it's short and sweet, it's just like, it's Benny, he makes music, check it out. That's pretty good, I think.
Yeah. Have you ever had an introduction where it's just like mean all the way through, and you're like, "Oh my god, this is gonna be one of those kind of interviews"?
Not for music stuff, but I have had other kinds of podcast interviews that from the get go, it was sort of like it would be like, you know, someone being like, "And here's John Corks from Canada," and then like there's a whole introduction where like everything's wrong,
right?
And then
yeah,
you're like, do I even bother to
fix it? Yeah,
my name is similar to a bunch of other people's names, not artist name, but other names, and I get a lot of other people's emails,
right?
So it's sort of like every once in a while, every fifth email, I'll be like, is this actually for me?
Yeah,
this is weird. Like, I don't remember this vacation photo. Who is this person? Oh, it's not for me. So
right,
at least as long as the intro matches me in some way.
Then you're good. Then you're good. So usually, very seldom do I find a Wikipedia bio, you know, because usually I go off of the website, you know.
Yeah.
But every now and then I go off of the Wikipedia bio. And I say that bio from Wikipedia, and then I ask them if it's right or not.
Oh, smart!
You know? And then they'll say no, because you can't trust Wikipedia. You know, I'm sure. Well, you might have one. I don't know. I don't have a Wikipedia. Okay. Yeah.
After I win my third and fourth Grammys, then I'll get the Wikipedia.
Yes.
But first, I probably have to win the first and second.
Yeah.
And then at first I'd be nominated. But all those things in reverse, eventually there'll be a Wikipedia. And then I'll hate it. And I'll be like, I can't believe this Wikipedia is up and it's all wrong.
Right, yeah. So according to my Spotify, which is, I guess, is the number one platform now. The Apple was
probably,
on
yeah.
It says you have 6 EPs. Your first EP was in 2020. Is that factually true? Because I know most artists start way before and release their albums like, you know, 5 years from now or something, you know. But I guess you always were in music.
Well, okay, so that's a good question. I think, let's see, does it say 6 EPs? Let me see.
I'm counting 6 EPs right here.
You gotta click show all, and then you see Hear My Rattle, there's The Bell, there's Lee, there's Wait for What, A Happy Childhood, Thea, Lullabies for Grown-Ups, Marina's Lament, and Repeat Town.
Got it.
So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
9, okay.
And I have a 10th one coming out. And actually, the 10th one is the final one of the Muted Circus.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I see it too, and this is 2019, so my apologies.
It's okay.
Yeah, but you've been busy since then.
And I didn't do anything before that.
So I really want to get into this with you because your PR, Charles, I don't know if I can say his last name, but big shout out to Charles.
Charles Cormier.
Yes, thank you for that. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I could say his last name or not. But he mentioned that your father was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer.
Yeah.
And that made you like go out of music for a while, or was it the other way? Like come back.
It was the other way. So my story, I grew up with music. I started playing violin when I was 7 years old. Had a very common thing for like a certain kind of family where it's like all the kids play instruments. I played violin. I got into guitars, bass, played in bands, got really into music. I went to music school, and at music school, you play so much and you expose yourself to so much music. But I also sort of realized at music school that I wasn't that good.
Okay, yeah, because it says you went to Berklee College of Music, right?
I went to Berklee College of Music, But it's actually a really funny thing about realizing that you're not good, because in a certain sense, music is... It's like deciding that the tree in your yard is not a nice tree or something. You're like, what are you talking about? Like, it's a tree. Like, of course it's a nice tree. I mean, it's not an oak tree that, you know, is 80 feet tall, but it's still a nice tree, right? It's sort of music school had that effect on me, where you're surrounded by people that are so physically virtuosic or so expressive or have so much vocal range or have so much richness in their musical expression that you look at your own expression and you say, okay, yeah, I don't really have that. And so that led me away, and I worked in the music industry, and I moved to Japan, and I did all this other stuff that was sometimes music adjacent, but not really. And it wasn't until my dad was diagnosed with cancer where I was like, oh, I have all these emotions.
Mm.
And I knew what to do with them.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, dusted off the guitar, and I decided to spend a lot of time alone. And I rented a little rehearsal space down the street from my apartment. And I used to go there on Thursday mornings and Sunday mornings for usually 3 or 4 hours. And I would just be alone, and I would play music by myself. And I started to write more songs. And then I started to be like, these songs kind of suck. Are they good? I don't know. And then I started to be like, okay. And I think a lot of artists or musicians, a lot of them have like a sort of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially if you listen to like SoundCloud rappers or something, like that's what it's all about, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I had this sort of opposite where I was like, well, I don't like my voice. I don't like my songwriting ability. I don't like these things, but I've set aside all this time to work on them, because that was the way I was channeling all this emotion, that I spent a lot of time alone and a lot of time working on these things and trying to find my own voice in this way. And then as I started to write more and more, I started to envision how they might come together in recordings. So I started to record the sessions and work to try to bring them to albums. And if you listen to the first albums, they're really sparse. And then they sort of get richer and richer, and then they're pretty much full band productions. But I really had to relearn everything from scratch, and really ask myself the question over and over again, like, is this good? Is this not good? And then you have to overcome all those regular questions to decide, am I going to release this? You know, then you have to face the fact that no one's going to listen to it and all the normal things that you deal with.
Right. Yeah. I think 99.999 infinity of musicians struggle with, is anybody going to listen to this? You know, because I think that musicians and music producers are more like perfectionists, you know.
Mm.
But it's all perspective, you know, because you might think your music sucks to you, but to me, it's like a lifesaver, you know.
Yeah.
It's beautifully imperfected. I don't know if I said that right.
Yeah, beautifully imperfect.
Yes, thank you. That you can think of something, but it means so much to me. And that, you know,
I agree. I think it's such a funny. It's a funny thing that I think about a lot, especially as I get older. There's sort of, more and more I feel like there are things that feel right to you, or to me, you should say. They feel right to me, or they don't feel right. And life tends to be better when there are more things that just feel right. And I always, and sometimes people ask me, like, well, how do you know if something feels right? And it's sort of like if you had a big family, like 10 or 15 people, and you sort of imagined your whole family one by one and like scanned the whole family. Most of the people in your family, if you have a pretty functional family, you're going to be like, that's fine. But then there'll be that like one cousin that the last time you saw them, you were a little worried about them, and they stick out like a sore thumb. And they're doing okay, but that's the cousin that you should probably keep an eye on. And that's the cousin you should send a note to and like check in on and
maybe
go a little, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that sort of scan, it requires a lot of sensitivity, because I'm not scanning my own music for, is this going to pop on TikTok? I can't do that. I don't know.
Right.
TikTok's not like buzzing stuff. Like, it's just not my thing. You
TikTok's
know?
Been but, weird, bro. It's like, oh, well, yeah, yeah.
No, but a lot of people do have a really great sense for it. Like, oh, this is going to like smash at the club or something. I don't know.
Right.
But for me, so I only have to listen to my own resonance. I only have to say, you know, this vocal take is okay for me. It feels right to me. And I think where a lot of musicians go wrong is they don't really hone their own sense of whether it feels right to them because they're working with an outside producer or there's some sort of pressure that they're feeling to do something and they sort of miss those signals. And it requires much, much later that they look back and they go, wow, this really isn't good. And so when I listen back to my music, even though I could say like some of it I don't think is very good or whatever, it's really just based on my own resonance and not really based on any sort of
right.
other indication. Like, does it feel right to me or not?
Yeah.
It's pretty selfish in a
right.
good way. You know?
Yeah. Right. Well, in a very good way. Now that you said that, here's the question that I think you get asked a lot of times, but I just am curious myself. How do you know, with that being said, your perfection plays a big role in knowing when a song is done?
Mm.
How do you know that? With being, I mean, you know.
Sure. Well, it's funny because all the songs that are released are de facto done. Makes sense.
Yeah.
But when I listen back to them now, I feel like a lot of them aren't finished.
Okay.
So I think that there's, well, if you think about the way most music is made, and in particular the way that I made my music, it's a very common way to do it, which is you have a chord progression and you have lyrics and you have a melody and you basically have an arrangement, how you think it's going to come together. And then you start recording it and you start with basic tracks, and basic tracks can vary based on your instrumentation, but basic tracks, okay, we're going to have a click, have nice time, and I'm going to record acoustic guitar. And then I'm going to put the first layer of vocals on it to get a little bit of a sense of how the vocals will lay, but that's not the final vocals. And then I'm going to add a little bass, and I'm going to this. And you sort of have this building, and then you take it to a certain point, then you start to add the vocals and the backing vocals, and you're building this little thing. Your ears, every time you push play back again and again and again, they do what you could maybe call like chunking. You've ever heard the phrase chunking? So it's like why you don't sense all of the details of the street you live on when you go down it. But if you're in a foreign country, you sense all these details. It's because your brain is just putting these things together in a way. So you almost instantly lose perspective on your own music. You almost instantly lose perspective. And so at a certain point, you just get this feeling of like, oh, I don't need to add anything more.
Right.
I think this feels like if I added something more, it would be too much. And it feels like a full thing. It's like if you have a spoonful of like very rich chocolate mousse or something, only like a certain kind of chocolate freak would be like, this actually needs more cocoa.
Right.
Or like more cream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that you sort of end up at this point. But then as I developed as a producer and as I developed as a songwriter, when I listen back to a lot of my tracks, I think, you know, that idea, I actually rushed that a little bit. It really needed more space, or I really should have had percussion in this, or more percussion. I really should have. And I think that should have feeling is actually really healthy. And I think probably I will eventually just do a Muted Circus album where I take my favorite tracks and I rework them. And even now, like on piano and other instruments, I'm always like going back to the songs and thinking, what if you shift the perspective of the lyric,
this maybe instead of being,
or maybe if I reharmonize this, like change the chords underneath the melody, maybe it could come to life a little bit more. This feels like it drags a little bit.
Right.
I feel that. Yeah. I really feel that a lot. But in the moment, you really feel like this is done.
Right. Yeah.
I can't think of anything more to add. Like, it's right. done.
But yeah. But when it's released, you're like, oh man, I should have done it. Yeah. My next question today, and I think you just answered it for me. I was going to ask you, are you thinking about doing like a remix album But I bet you just say that like a revision slash remake,
yeah,
kind of, sort of. I don't know.
Well, so there currently is 45 songs that I've released, and the whole thing is 50 songs long, and let's see, 20 out of 50 of those are instrumental. Because I play violin and viola, and I had a vision where I wanted three vocal songs and an interlude that was instrumental in between. I feel like maybe 10 or 12 of those songs deserve another version for me.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's not like fan demand. People send you messages all the time being like,
right, you know, man, you should fix that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Fix it. Or like add more drums to this.
Yeah, or do something.
But I feel like there's, and then a lot of those songs, I feel like they really had a place in the EPs, but they're sort of not critical to the whole message. So I feel like maybe I'll do an album, yeah, and I'll reopen the tracks and I'll use bits and pieces that I like and I'll redo some and maybe try to have it a little bit more focused, because the tracks are kind of all over the place. Like there's lots of different genres mixed in and things like that.
You said that 20 out of those 50 songs are instrumental, right?
Yeah.
So with that said, would the instrumental songs be more easier?
Easier is word. Good.
Yeah. Would they be easier to kind of tweak more easier than the ones, sure, with music and lyrics? Because I know lyrics can be, yeah, so kind of tough, because when you write those lyrics, they're from your heart, you know?
Sure.
And you don't want to, yeah, no singer wants to rechange the structure in those lyrics, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, just to touch on that lyrical point, I think, yeah, that when I was writing these songs, I was trying to capture a really deep sadness that I was feeling. And we're not talking about depression. We're just talking about sadness. We're talking about the kind of sadness that's plagued humanity since Adam and Eve times.
Yeah.
Since they had children, like, you had sadness, you had grief, you had parental loss. It's like just such a natural thing. And I wanted to face those feelings. So I spent a lot of time with those feelings. And what I've realized looking back is that a lot of the songs are more like, they're very indirect. It wasn't until later, fourth, fifth EP, where I actually kind of start to face it more directly. So an example of that would be one of my tracks is about two children, two young adults being found dead in a river. And it's called Fair Detective. And it's from the perspective of the detective who's trying to figure out what happened, for example.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, true crime kind of thing, a little, right, bit sad. But there's a lot of storytelling in between my personal feelings of loss and the story I'm telling. There's a lot of layers. There's the detective's feelings. There's the parents' feelings. There's the children who are dead. And all these things come into play. And I think that there are ways to collapse the distance.
Right.
That I avoided, if that makes sense. So an example of that would be if I was rewriting Fair Detective, which I will not probably, but if I were rewriting it,
right,
you could say, well, in the song, I'm the detective. So I'm viewing the dead bodies and talking about them, and I'm meeting the parents who are dealing with the death of their child. Mm. That's the perspective I chose. But if you listen to the song carefully, you realize that I am both the detective and I'm the parent who lost the child.
Oh, okay.
In the bridge, like, I become the parent. So yeah, you could sort of say, okay, that muddies the image of it. So, but tweaks like that aren't that hard to change. Does that make sense? I'm taking like a very long story, but no, if you're simply going to change she to I,
mm-hmm,
well, that's interesting.
Right. That puts it on you now. Right.
It could put it on you. And that's such a small tweak that maybe if you were like a hardcore, like Bob Dylan fan who listened to like Deep Cut number 55, you'd be like, aha.
Yeah, I got it. Right.
You know, but from my perspective, that would be a very significant change to be like, the song was about he, but now it's about I.
Right.
Okay. You only have to change 5 words in the whole song to make it all make sense. But now it has a totally more immediate feeling to it. So I think those kinds of lyric changes I am really strongly considering and sort of trying to understand my perspective, my position, doing air quotes, in the song.
Right.
Now, instrumental ones, well, I mean, on a fundamental level, music is rhythm and it's melody and it's harmony.
Right.
And melodies, you can change melodies, but usually when you reharmonize or rework a song, if you change the melody too much,
it becomes
you can lose different. Some of the essence of the song.
Right.
And there's certain sort of like shapes of a song that really make it shape. Like, I don't know if you hear those guys on Instagram or whatever, they'll take like a song in minor key and turn it into a major key.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, there's like a famous one of like Nirvana was like, what if Kurt Cobain was happy? And then they take right. like a really sad
right.
song
yeah.
and make it major. Yeah. So if you like do a dramatic change like that, you can really just like lose the essence of a song.
Right.
But harmonically, you actually can do a lot of changes in the underlying chord structure or the way it builds, the way it feels, without someone immediately being like, this is a different song. They'd be like, oh, that's interesting. An example of that, a famous example might be if you listen to the pianist Brad Mehldau's version of Blackbird by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it generally has the same structure harmonically, but it's very different harmonically. A lot more rich chords, a lot more chord changes, a lot more going on. And you still can identify, like, this is Blackbird.
Right.
You know? So I would say that, yes, instrumental songs are more malleable in a certain sense, but they kind of, you can add a lot more to them, but you can subtract more from them. But it kind of, I think it's pretty equivalent to
right.
What you can do with vocal songs.
Mm,
sorry, I'm such a music nerd. Like I,
oh yeah,
I take the music questions really,
very, very. Seriously. Oh, I love you for that. Yes, yeah, so, yeah, I love you for that. That's great. Yeah, yeah.
You can tell I'm not like PR trained.
Oh, that's great. I love you for that. Okay, so it's safe to say that most of your songs are in a sad.
Yeah.
Depression, kind of mourning, lost state, right?
Yeah.
Is that because that happened after you found out that your dad had a terminally brain cancer?
Yeah.
Or what? Or okay, okay.
100%. So
okay,
what happened was, my dad had like a stroke-like incident,
mm-hmm.
rushed to the hospital, brain scan, found a tumor in his brain. And the doctors said, well, we don't think it's cancer, but we're going to operate on it. The whole family flew in,
right.
The whole thing,
right.
Where you're like, you know, brain surgery, if anyone who's listening has been involved or near it, it's similar to heart surgery in a way, but a little bit more intense, where the brain, like, it really shouldn't be opened up, but they have to open it up,
yeah.
And that's like a very serious...
Right.
Very serious thing.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the moment I learned that he had cancer was when you're waiting for hours and hours and hours for them to do the surgery and the doctor comes out and I was the one who was there sitting there. And the doctor was like, we did the surgery. We removed the tumor, but I'm fairly certain that it's cancer and we still have to run labs and like confirm it, but I'm pretty sure it's cancer. And it's sort of like everyone who's experienced this kind of thing knows that typically your instinct is like, we're going to fight this thing.
Yeah,
but
right.
In that moment, the doctor was like, if it's cancer, it's terminal.
Mm.
And they can maybe slow it, but, you know, and then you ask, well, how long does he have to live? And then they say, oh, well, most people have this condition live 18 months to 2 years. Okay, fine. But my dad's still asleep, right? He is asleep for a lot longer before they can wake him up. And then you have to, so you have this initial trauma of being like, dad's suddenly sick. Then you have the next trauma of the doctor telling you that something's seriously wrong. Then you have the next trauma of having to witness your dad find out that he's going to die. Then you have the next, like, so you end up in this perpetual state of like,
next, right.
Yeah. Where, and then you have to experience a man who's very strong and very healthy, who's been married for 40 years and their family has been very close, sort of like the pillow of the family, dealing with their own demise, as you could say. And so it's like a very, it's very different from my friends whose dad got a heart attack and died.
Right.
Because they're processing the death of the father, their death of their father and that state, but they're not, they don't have to live with the death. The dyingness, if that makes sense.
Right.
So that what that does is
they're not waiting for, you know.
They're not waiting. That's right.
Yeah.
And you're not in the suspended state, which I know I'm sure people who listen to this who have dealt with a terminal relative or someone that's dying or even a grandparent totally understands this feeling. And I wrote a song called Wait for What that is basically just
Right.
It's just like, what are we waiting for? We're waiting for the most important person in all of our lives to die.
Right. And that's like what very, very difficult for anybody to go.
Very difficult. And it's also, it's interesting mental state to be in because in some senses that form is very modern because it's only in recent medical terms where you'd really know that someone's going to die. Mm-hmm. So with like a medical certainty, they can be like, your father will be dead. There's no world in which he's going to survive. Right. There's no miracle cure around the corner. This is the kind of cancer that will kill him. Like that's so anyway, long story short, you end up with a lot of time trying to live, trying to process this, trying to be there for them, trying to be there for family, trying to get as much as you can out of their time left with you, but also create enough emotional distance that you're not going to be totally destroyed when they eventually do leave because you know they're going to leave. And I had never dealt with that stuff, dude. Yeah, I'm like a happy kid, always been done my thing, never had to worry about stuff. So that meant that I had a lot of time and a lot of new emotions. And so I tried to package all these into songs, but if you listen to it, it's a drab 90 EPs for the most part about parents and parents dying and parents disappearing. And, and it's very literal, you know?
Right. Right.
And that's part of the reason why I want to finish it with 10 EPs.
Okay.
Maybe do the album and like move on to other things. I've written a lot of other music. That's not part of this project that I haven't released.
So now that you said that, let me ask you this. Okay.
Sure.
After this 10th EP, which is coming out soon, right?
Or I haven't decided when I'm going to release it. But,
It's in the works, everybody, right?
Okay, it's done. So it's totally done. Mix and master, just sitting on my hard drive.
Okay. Find the release date, right?
Yeah.
All right. So when this EP releases, hopefully soon, but you know, okay. So are we going to get a happier Muted Circus? Because I will rephrase this, okay? Yeah. I'm sure you and your dad are two peas in a pod, you know? It's like you've had many, many, many great memories, right?
Yeah.
So what if we get a Muted Circus on the opposite end of that instead
of... You could do that.
Yeah, because I know that, I mean... Dads are like, you know, one in a million and
your dad just called you right before we started.
He did. Exactly. Yeah. But I'll have to call you back, Dad.
There's a special song for you.
Okay.
The final song of the 10th EP. It's called Disconnection.
Okay.
And it's about phone calls with my father.
Yes. Yes.
Because
a lot of people take those calls for granted. You know,
they do. And in my case, I called my dad almost every day. And even when I lived in Japan and I'd call him in the morning, it'd be his evening. I called him almost every day.
Right.
And it's funny, like some people carry a lot of regret when they lose a loved one. Oh, I should have spent more time with them. I should have done this, should have done that. That's not something that I felt at all. Right. I felt like I really did I really spent a lot of time with him. I really knew him well. I really called him all the time and you know, understood, which I think is beautiful. And if you're listening to this and your parents are still around, you know, give them a call, even if you hate them. No, I'm just
kidding. I love them. Right, sometimes get over nerves, but I love them too, you know, well, so it's kind of a yin and yang, you know? Right.
Well, it's funny, your dad called you because he called you back. Do you usually call him or does he call you?
Usually he calls me, but most now I call him, you know. I mean it works either way. You know, but if he has to hear from me in like a week, you know, he will say, "Hey, James Biden, you know, come on, man, you need to," you know, and I'm like, "Oh, okay," you know, but it's not busy. It's just, I don't know why, you know, I guess time slips away from me, but I need to do better about, you know, keeping up with my mom and dad, because my mom's not doing very well. My dad's okay. My mom is not doing very well right now, so I guess I should.
That's
I think
that I've always felt that a cadence of conversations, they accrue over time,
right?
And even like a 2 to 5 minute conversation more frequently can really lift someone's spirits or kind of plant a flag that plant a tree, so to speak, that like grows. But anyway, the question of like, I think that just like if you do exercise or you play guitar or something, what you practice, you get better at.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of practice writing slower, kind of sadder songs.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's actually really, it's hard for me to write songs that aren't slow and sad now.
Right.
I think it would be a lot of work if I was going to write songs that weren't slow and sad.
Right.
But what I'm thinking is that even the name Muted Circus comes, it's part of family lore, like my father's family lore, or my father's, I can explain what it means, but it was an art project that my dad did in the early 70s that I think it was an installation. No one really remembers too much about it. And it was always just like two words that floated around a lot. So it was like kind of part of that. But the reason why I'm saying that is that it's really a bucket of feelings and emotions that I don't know if I want to keep adding to. I think I maybe just make a new artist name and start again with a different kind of feeling.
Well, 10 EPs, I think, you got all your anger and your boniness out, you know.
Yes.
And that's a lot of music for having one or two moods, is what you call it, you know, anger and. So I was gonna suggest, you know, you could take it for what it is, but you could go like Muted Circus Resurrection or something, you know, resurrection up and just you know, beat you. I don't know, you know, I'm just thinking out loud, you know.
But no, it's cool. Yeah, I like it. Yeah. Well, it's funny. I attempted. I think that one of the saddest. I think there's two EPs in the middle. Wait for What?
Yeah.
And A Happy Childhood.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, in retrospect, because Wait for What really is the most direct. That's where my father's voice appears, a recording of him actually talking about his own death.
Right.
He's talking to my brother in the car and he's having a conversation about his own death. And it's a very beautiful testament to the way he thought and the way he lived, because he was basically saying, "I'm dying and it's good."
Right.
Like I'm more alive than I've ever been, basically, is what he's saying. And I'm dying, which is like a really beautiful thing. So there's that. And then the EP immediately following that is called A Happy Childhood. And I had a friend, or I guess it wasn't a friend, it was an acquaintance from the other day, said to me, like, "Oh, A Happy Childhood, that must be ironic, right?" And I was like, oh, no. I had an amazingly happy childhood.
Right.
So my attempt at writing happy songs ended up being like kind of syrupy reminiscence.
Right.
Like being young and like how great it was.
Right.
So, yeah. I think that there's no real humor in the album. And that's a shame, because I consider myself like a pretty happy-go-lucky person. Mm-hmm. So I think you get a really weird impression of me as like some sort of sad person.
Right.
Even though
that's even though you're not. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But going back to when you asked me why did I pick up when my dad calls me, a song immediately like popped in my mind, and I'm sure you can agree with Cats in the Cradle, right?
Yeah, sure.
It's kind of like that's like the yin and yang, you know. And I think that's natural for everybody to have a life that is worth, I don't know what I'm saying here. You forget to take on your parents because you think that they're always going to be here.
Yeah.
You know? But then life gets involved and you're doing this and this and this. I don't know why, you know. I don't know what I'm trying to say, you know.
Well, I think it's weird. I think that one of the things, as people get older, you realize all the faults of your parents for good and bad things, but you realize the sort of, oh, like this is just a person.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And if you love them and you really care about them, that's actually very different from really enjoying their company.
Right.
Like I have lots of friends that love their parents incredibly, but they don't want to talk to them every day.
Right.
They annoy them. You know, like they ask annoying questions. They say stupid things that bug them. They whatever. Like all that stuff makes perfect sense. So I'm not really advocating that every single person like has the kind of relationship with their parent where they call them every day and like check in or whatever. But if that is the type of relationship you have, that is also a beautiful thing. Someone that you is a confidant that you can talk with, that you can check in with, that sort of, I always think of my dad like a secretary in a certain sense. He'd remember everything and sort of you'd call him and be like, hey, you remember that? How's that? You remember you had lunch with your friend, you know, blah, blah, blah last week. How'd that go? Was that fun? You know what I mean? And you're like, oh, wow, you remember. It's like, well, yeah, because you only tell him like three or four things maximum when you call anyway. So I think that it's really about cherishing the kind of relationship you have with your parent and looking on the bright side of it,
right?
Whatever it is, and trying to respect them as a person, even if you know all their flaws.
Yeah, awesome. I really want to touch on a subject before we let you go. I got a few more questions for you, but sure. But I do thank you for coming on today, talk with me.
Appreciate you having me.
I think that I remember reading the email from Charles that said that you toured with a well-known musician.
Oh, yes.
You didn't, we all know that the music industry is very dark sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to ask, you don't have to say the person you toured with.
I played bass with a Sony artist soon after I finished music school. And it actually was a very good experience overall.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like touring at all.
Okay.
I like don't like hotel yeah. rooms that much. I just didn't feel, it didn't feel right.
You didn't feel connected
to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a certain way. And I think that part of it is that I gravitate towards games that I can win.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like some people challenge themselves to like make some crazy thing for dinner that they've never thought they could make or something. I'm like not that type of person. I'm like, I want to make things that I like know how to make and it's going to end up okay, you know?
Right.
And that's how I sort of live my life. Like I don't take big risks. And when I was out on tour, I was just like, I have a lot of energy and I don't really want to be devoting my energy to this other person's band, this other person's stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think it's, in some ways that was the right thing for me to do at that young age, 22 or whatever.
Right.
But also one thing I've become more and more aware of as I get older is when you take yourself out of a situation that's pretty, pretty good, you actually, it's pretty good, but not right for you. You actually produce a fantastic opportunity for someone else. So you're doing a double disservice. You're doing a disservice to yourself by hanging in there just because you don't really have anything else to do and it's like, okay, but not great. You're doing a disservice because it doesn't feel right to you. And you're also doing a disservice to the universe because you're not allowing someone else to take that position. I mean, if you want to be like the most, we definitely should not be talking about politics because that's
right.
But
yeah,
but if you want to tell like a little flavor of politics,
yeah.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a good example.
Right.
She was elderly. She was on the Supreme Court. She could have left at a time when a Democrat could have been nominated, but she hung on and she died at an inopportune time. And that's a double loss if you're on the liberal side. Not that it matters, it's a double loss because you lost a great Supreme Court justice and you lost the opportunity for another similar Supreme Court justice to be able to take the seat. So, I mean, those who are listening who are on one side or the other are probably yelling something like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was terrible for America or something. No. But in a certain sense, even though I was very young and it wasn't right for me, as soon as I said, hey, this isn't right for me and I'm out, no one was mad at me. Well, maybe for a brief moment.
A little bit.
Right. I know that somebody stepped into that role and they were able to either learn that they also didn't like that kind of role or they really blossomed in that. And they went on to play for many other artists and bigger artists and had a great career.
Yeah.
That's kind of an older person's perspective on it, I think.
Dude, I swear to God, you don't look more than 26 years old, to be honest.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm well preserved.
Right. I am too. I'm 45, but I'm
40. I just turned 40.
Nice. You're younger than me. Oh, yeah, brother. Yeah. We're
aging. Yeah, I'm younger than you.
We're aging like 5 miles.
I'll always be 5 years younger than you. It doesn't matter what happens.
Exactly. My sister will be always a year older than me, so I got that honor always, you know.
That's right. You're always you're looking a year older than me today.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So I got two fun questions and two hard questions, okay? And then we'll wrap it up, okay? Two fun questions, though. Which I'm sure you've asked this before, but I just wanted to know, okay. So if you could have dinner with any musician dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Oh, man. Part of me wants to say like a pie in the sky musician like Bob Dylan, even though I know it would be the most awkward dinner ever and he probably wouldn't even talk. But I think I would really like to resurrect and have dinner with the piano player Chick Corea.
Okay.
He just had such a vibrant soul, and when I listen to his music, I sort of see into a beautiful space that I don't normally see into, and I just think he would have been a really nice person to spend some time with. So I think I'd choose him at least in 2025.
There you go. Right. All right. Okay. So the second question. There's a whole lot of songs from now till like back in like 1920s. Like, is there one song you wished to God you have written?
You know what's so funny? There's so many songs that I was like clever, I would think of. But I had this weird thought. Do you know that like Tin Pan Alley Soon song, Putting on the Ritz? Have you ever heard that song? It's like,
yes.
Putting on the Ritz.
Yeah.
I think probably I'd choose.
Probably that one. Why?
It's just I think that there's like so many silly, silly songs. Like the Happy Birthday song. It's like if you just sat down on the piano and you're like, oh, let's do a Happy Birthday. Like, how amazing would that be if that was your musical legacy? And somehow I think Putting on the Ritz is like so frivolous, but also so interesting. And I think there are a lot of songs that have like similar frivolity to it. Like there's a song, Salt Peanuts. Have you ever heard that? Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. Like that kind of thing. It's just like, it has like a frenetic energy. It's silly. It people are really attracted to it. They keep coming back to it. So I probably would choose a song that was kind of that.
Go. All right. Nice. Two of the harder questions. So
okay, yeah, I'm ready. I'm very okay. Serious face now.
Right. Well, these are fun / hard, and I'm sure you'll knock these out of the park. So I would ask you about Mount Rushmore and your four favorite artists or bands. You got four of them. Who would they be?
Okay, that's a really good question. I'm not going to try to be clever with this one at all. Because
okay. Stick with what you know, right?
and it's going to be a weird mountain for sure.
Perfect. I love weird.
I think I would revert to the artist that I really liked when I was a teenager, because those, you know how when you're a teenager you're very sensitive, and like there's all the. I would probably put Bob Dylan on the mountain.
He's got to go up there for sure.
You've also got so many records,
right? I mean, yeah,
they've got like 50 albums or something. It's like crazy. There's a lot of material there.
It's insane.
I would put Dave Mustaine from Megadeth on there.
I love you for that. I love Megadeth, bro. I love it more than Metallica, dude. But yeah, so
me too. Oh, yeah. 100%. I put Dave Mustaine up there.
See, back in my high school days, I listened to nothing but Metallica. But 20s and now it's like Megadeth all the way, you know, because they're consistent, you know.
I think they're consistent, and also I love the silliness factor, the humor, especially in the earlier albums. Metallica is very self-serious, which is good. I mean, there's some really great songs, but that like sneering kind of silly, and the feel, that like kind of swinging metal feel, dun, 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 dun. I just love that. It's like amazing. So I put Dave Mustaine there.
Okay, let me ask you one more. Okay, so what's your favorite Megadeth album of all time?
Countdown to Extinction.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
How about you?
Mine would be a tie between that one and Risk.
Risk is amazing.
Everybody hates on it though, and I'm like, dude, it's called Risk. They were taking a risk. You know, and a lot of people don't understand that.
The Risk is like a little bit more poppy.
Right, yeah.
It has like Into the Arena and stuff on it.
Very poppish, yeah.
I actually like that on too. And actually, that's how I know you're a hardcore Megadeth fan.
Yeah.
Not because of any like, real fans know that Risk is good. But what Countdown to Extinction and that sort of trajectory, it was getting poppier.
Yes.
And then they took a big risk and they made a like almost like a pop album.
Yeah.
And
it was great.
And if that was where you entered Megadeth, maybe it would have been confusing to you. And if you're really into thrash metal, that would have been confusing to you.
Right.
But it sort of fit in a way. Like Euthanasia is amazing. Like there's so many good things in there. Yes. And I think Risk is actually a really enjoyable album. And I think it would be a really good and enjoyable album, even if it wasn't a Megadeth album. If that makes sense.
What was that one after Risk? Because I really like that one too. The one with the gray cover.
And I'm forgetting.
Too. Wesley's, yeah.
If I knew this would be a Megadeth quiz,
I know. But that was a great album. They consistently had good albums up until I think it was.
But man, I have two more people I need to put on this mountain. That's really tricky.
Yeah.
Man. I'm gonna have to stall. Okay.
Yeah.
I might even put Danny Elfman up there.
Okay.
He's done a lot of great stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Danny Elfman's done a lot of great stuff for so many years. And most people that aren't like us don't understand Oingo Boingo.
Oingo Boingo. Yeah.
You know, and those early Oingo Boingo albums, Only a Lad and all those early ones, there's so much creativity in those. Yeah. Amazing. Right. So I'd probably put Danny Elfman up there. And then I would probably choose, I really like classical and I really like jazz. We didn't put any jazz people up in there, but that's okay. Because I mentioned Chick Corea earlier, so I did my duty.
Right.
I would probably put... It's funny because you have to choose. Like, do you want to do the player or do you want to do the composer?
Right.
You know, or do you want to do like Leonard Bernstein or something? Mm-hmm. Who's not he composed a lot. Maybe I'll put Leonard Bernstein up there. Sure. Okay. I'll put Leonard Bernstein there. You know,
and I know it's
the New York Philharmonic.
And I know it's going to change as soon as you get off the line with me. You're like, damn it, I should have been this one, you know, or something.
Yeah,
you know,
I'll be like, we need to carve more faces on this. Right, yeah. But yeah, I think those stick out to me, and they all sort of relate to my interests from a young age and continue through. So I feel pretty good about that.
Nice. Okay. So last question is going to be harder than the previous one. Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready? All right. Okay. Is there one artist, album, or song that you can listen to right now, but you can't tell me, your parents, your friends, how it makes you feel deep inside your soul?
Oh, man. Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Should I tell you the song?
Yes. Yes, please do.
There's a song, an outtake by Bob Dylan called Moonshiner. It's, and anyone who, don't go listen to my music, go listen to Bob Dylan sing Moonshiner. It's a very simple song. It's very beautiful. And it also doesn't really, like, if you think about a song like Townes Van Zandt, Waiting Around to Die, which is also an amazing song. If you haven't heard that, just Google Waiting Around to Die. Amazing song. That song really, it like hits you in the face because it's a song about someone that's just like their whole life and they're just like waiting around to die. Similar to my like wait for what kind of thing.
Kind of like what we discussed earlier.
But,
yeah.
But Moonshiner is a song about a man who's a moonshiner who makes moonshine. And it's just about him living and his work. Like, that's all it's about. So that's when you said, like, you maybe you're friends of him, you wouldn't understand, like, why it resonates so deeply. I think that in some ways, we have work to do on this earth. And if we lose track of the work to do, we really lose track of what we're doing at all. And it doesn't need to be one big narrative. It can be a million little things that you do. But there's things that get set in front of you that you do. And somehow that song Moonshiner kind of touches that feeling for me. It's like, he's making moonshine. He's going to the bar and drinking and doing, but there's something about it. It's like about a person and their life and their work. And it resonates with me very deeply.
Perfect. But that's perfect. Perfect response to a perfect song. So I thank you for that. Okay. So let's give you a couple of shout outs now. You can visit Meter Circus on the website, metercircus.bandcamp.com. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. And you can go to, you can buy his song, Hear My Rattle. His album, his EP album,
yeah.
Hear My Rattle for $5 or more. You know, you get to.
Yeah, if you want to pay, you can pay. I'll take the $5.
There you go. I always try to support, you know, physically. And
yeah, so. You bought my record. I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah.
You bought them all. You I bought them all. $4,000.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'm broke now, everybody. Yeah. So all right. So he is also on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/meted-circus. Check out all of his stuff right there. And he's leaving on Facebook at Meted Circus. So you said you're on TikTok too, and I know you got
TikTok. Instagram. I'm not on TikTok, but I'm on Instagram, even though I don't make any posts. So that's not. Okay. I'm not super into social media stuff these days, but maybe one day I will be. Maybe one day I'll go viral. What do you think about that, James?
Well, let's get you viral, man. You know. Oh yeah. So. Let's get me viral for it because I got to pay you back on that $4,000.
Smart. I appreciate that. Okay. We'll get you going. We'll get you viral first and then I'll
let's
get
help
you.
Each other. Yes.
I'll be right. Like the other friend in the Haktua conversation. The other person.
You're right. Yeah. The other one. Right. Yeah. So, like I said before.
Thank you so much, James. I really appreciate it. It was really
fun. Like I said before, we do love you here and we honestly welcome you to come back anytime you want to. And
anytime you want a little dose of sadness, I'm ready for that. No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe next time we'll have you for to be on your happy EPs or something. What, you know, whatever you whatever you do in your future, I'm sure it would be great.
Perfect.
You know, yeah. So, all right. And with that said, everybody, thank you for listening. And always remember, when words fail, music speaks.